Well, it's interesting because in many ways, many times in Congress, a congressperson is playing to the camera, but it's an empty chamber. It's very interesting.
Right, right.
You know, we challenge our students. We say, why not change the world? Because we want them and try to educate them to be leaders. But in fact, one could say, and you have still quite a challenging leadership role, one of the most challenging, I think. Because as you've pointed out, you cannot fire your fellow justices. You can't
point it out wistfully.
Yes, I know. You can't dock their pay, right? They are your equals intellectually. Each of them has a ferocious command of the law. But yet you, in fact, have affirmed, and you've said it's better for the respect accorded to the court as a whole if there's consensus, you know, as often as possible. There isn't always, obviously. So what advice can you give our students about how you manage titans in those sorts of circumstances?
I think you do have to have, it's been said, a light grip on the reins, because mm-hmm. if you pull too hard, you'll find out they're not connected to anything. But I think one of the lessons I've learned, and frankly, it may be, maybe I learned it more at the Smithsonian than on the court, is that when you have a group, everybody is a leader in a certain sense. And on my court, it's the wrong way to refer to it, on the Supreme Court, some people are better at other things. An easy example, one thing we have to do every year is get money from Congress, just like every other federal entity. And so we send a couple of justices to Congress, explain what we need, and they get it. Now, I knew that there are people on the court who are better at that than I am. And so they go. I don't go. And they're leaders in the job of getting us adequate funding. There are people I know who, people on the court that I know are better at, in a particular case, perhaps explicating a point that I want to make. Well, I'll find a way during our conference discussion to make sure that she or he is the one who does that. So I think you can be a very effective leader when you appreciate that other people in particular areas can lead more effectively than you can.
So that maybe answers, in a way, partially my next question. You know, we've had a number of our graduates who've gone on to brilliant careers in intellectual property law. One of whom was Judge Arthur Gallarza, who was a member of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Now, the Patent Office itself deals with the very, you know, technical content of cases, and, you know, there was a closely watched case involving the CRISPR gene editing tool recently. But so there are times when the Supreme Court does deal with intellectual property and patent infringement. And so the real issue, and maybe it relates to what you said, how do judges who are generalists approach cases like that? Because most people are not scientists who end up there.
Well, first of all, it can be very hard. Your students know, in a way, but beyond my knowledge, that the difficulty of some of the technical concepts involved, and sometimes, as in a lot of cases, the law is in the details. So it's hard for us. We have to depend upon the lawyers who present the case to try to explain it to us. It's not just sort of dumbing down, but presenting it in terms that we can grasp, you know, in light of the legal issue. They know what's important given that. And we do have to look to them, and we have a very good Supreme Court bar that is able to do that. But at the end of the day, you have to realize that however a particular, the parties or lawyers might view a case may not be the way we view the case. It may be a very important patent case about this and this, but we might look at it as a statutory interpretation case in general. In other words, it might implicate how we would read any statute. It just happens to arise in a patent case. So a generalist tries to look at it in the broader sweep of the law, trying to be very careful not to make a mistake on the details. You know, and frankly, it is something that some of us, it may be an example of what I was talking about earlier. Some of my colleagues are much better at the technology than I am. So I'm going to listen more carefully to what they have to say than you know, my own understanding as I try to.
Do your law clerks have a role in helping in that regard as well?
Sure, they do, but they're typically not any more adept at the technology. Sometimes they are. And there again, you have to be very careful. The temptation to sort of look at, well, what does Wikipedia say about this? can be very strong. So you do have to look at better resources. They're often amicus briefs. You can tell the party said, all right, you, the association of whatever, or you try to explain it to them. Right. I'm going to talk about the law as much as I can, and then there's a resource, excuse me, that you can look at. But like in any legal process, there's going to be another brief on the other side. It's a scientific principle of a law that for every expert, there is an equal and opposite expert. So
that's good.
It's not mine originally.
You might pass our first physics course that way. Now, many people may not understand why I refer to you and why you are the Chief Justice of the United States with administrative responsibility over the entire federal judiciary and the leadership of a policy-making body, the Judicial Conference of the United States. Could you tell people a little bit more about what those duties entail and what your goals are for the federal judiciary?
Sure. The federal judiciary is a $10 billion enterprise spread across the United States, trying cases according to federal law and the Constitution, handling appeals, culminating in the Supreme Court. It needs, as I indicated, a big budget. I'm not talking about just the Supreme Court, federal courts all over the place. It needs a big budget. We have rules about how proceedings should be conducted. We make recommendations on things. Or do we need more judges? Where do we need courthouses? We have discipline questions. Thankfully, very, very few, but occasionally they come up. And questions like you suggested, cameras in the courtroom. Maybe it's a different answer if you're talking about the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. Maybe it's the same. And the Judicial Conference, which meets several times a year, addresses those issues and sets policy for the United States courts. It's an area very much along the lines of what I was talking about a little while ago. There are judges in the federal system much better at these sorts of things than I am. And I look to them, and they participate in the Judicial Conference discussions and provide leadership of their own. But at the end of the day, the responsibility rests with the conference, which consists of myself, the chief judges for the different circuits, the different geographic areas around the country, and a district judge from each of them. And, you know, some of what we do is very picayune and but it's the sort of stuff that any enterprise of that size has to resolve.
Now, one of your roles is assigning authorship of the majority opinion for the Supreme Court decisions if you voted with the majority. How do you go about making those decisions? And if you're not, if you haven't voted with the majority, how does that assignment get made?
Well, if I'm not in the majority, the senior justice in the majority will make the assignment, and I'll assign the dissent. It's frankly a fun process because there are a lot of different variables that you have to juggle. First thing is getting the work done. I mean, we don't leave toward the summer until all our work is done. Some of my colleagues work quickly, some of them not so quickly. So I have to make sure the assignment in a big case doesn't go to somebody who works slowly in April. It'll never get done. So I make sure to give that big assignment to somebody. That person gets a big assignment in October or November. I like it to be equal. At the end of the year, I like everybody to have pretty much the same number of opinions. But there are opinions and opinions. I mean, I want to make sure people have interesting cases, and we have dull cases. We call them the dogs. We want to make sure that there's an equal number of good cases and bad cases. I can't give anybody all the good cases. I like to distribute the subject matter. I can't have everybody doing just criminal cases, everybody doing just Fourth Amendment cases. I like to distribute the range of agreement. You don't want somebody doing just unanimous cases or just 5-4 cases. You want to mix that up a little bit. I even try to sort of, you know, put oil on water, and if you have two justices on opposite sides of a case, controversial in one sitting, maybe I'll try to find assignments for each of them where they're together in the next so they can move along. And it all has to come together. And it's really like a Rubik's Cube. As soon as you get all the things, well, that's good. Everybody has, you know, the right number of easy or hard cases. But then you turn and say, oh, but they're in the same subject matter, so I've got to change that. And then you change. It's a puzzle. It's a lot of fun. And it's also difficult. I have to be fair to myself during the whole process when I assign cases to myself and make sure I take my share of the bad ones as well.
Interesting. How do you foster collegiality? I mean, do you all socialize? What happens in the building, so to speak?
We have some things, practices we follow that I think are helpful. When we're hearing cases or in conference, which is about half the days every month, we eat lunch together. And we have a very strict rule that I enforce. There's no talk about business. So you do talk about movies, books, opera, baseball, children, all sorts of stuff, and you do get to know each other pretty well. Our jobs actually foster collegiality as well. Those of us roughly the same age, we hope we're serving with new Justice Gorsuch for 25 years. And if you're going to be with somebody for 25 years, you realize you can't sort of have, you know, the knockdown, drag out fight over a big case, because there was a big case last year, there'll be a big case next year, and if it's the same sort of thing for 25 years, that makes life pretty unbearable. So you learn that you're involved in the same enterprise, you've taken the same oath, you read the same briefs, the same cases, you hear the same arguments, and you have to find a way to each do your level best and appreciate that the other person is doing the same. It's kind of like a marriage, right? I mean, you hope it goes on for a long time, and you can't sort of have every fight be a huge fight.
It's true. That's true. Now, we do have some students who asked ahead of time to be able to ask you a few questions, and you know, we'll have them come forward. And if I could have the lights up, there was a student, Saretsi Kabanit Lakina, who had asked to raise a question.
Sure.
Please.
Oh, there.
I'll have to have my voice do the work. Thank you for coming today. Name is Kabanit Lakina. I'm a computer engineering senior here at RPI from South Africa. My question, seeing as you came to an academic institution, a lot of us here are trying to get ourselves prepared for an industry, and we're hoping to ourselves and maybe to a higher power that what we're doing here will prepare us adequately for the exact thing that we want to do after graduation. So my question for you then, seeing as you have a new colleague in Justice Gorsuch, is what did you do in school and also afterwards to prepare yourself for such a role? What sort of things did you do academically, extracurricularly, to prepare yourself to become a good candidate for the role and to succeed in the role? And also, what are some of the things that you wish you'd learned before that you ended up learning after having been appointed?
Okay.
Part of the answer is to appreciate. I don't remember ever wanting to be Chief Justice until it was presented to me. I don't remember wanting to be a justice. I don't remember wanting to be a judge or lawyer. I did not go to law school because I wanted to be a lawyer. I went to law school because it's clear that there were no jobs for historians. And that's what I wanted to do. And I thought, well, I have to do something. Maybe law is kind of like history, and you look at the old cases and all that. But when I went to law school, I found out I liked being a lawyer. So I became a lawyer. I never wanted to be a judge until I'd been a lawyer for 20, 25 years. I argued in front of the Supreme Court, and the opportunity came, do you want to be on the other side? I thought, yeah, that would be interesting. So I became a judge. It's foolish for a judge to say, I want to be a justice on the Supreme Court. That's very much a question of being hit by lightning in terms of the odds. So I wasn't looking forward to that. So it's more generally, I mean, The tools that make you a good lawyer make you a good judge, and they're not terribly surprising. If you want to be a lawyer, you have to learn, you have to like reading and writing. That's what lawyers do. They read cases, they read complaints, they write opinions, they write briefs, they write contracts. If you like reading and writing, and I like reading and writing, doing a lot of that is good preparation. Not reading law books so much, but good literature makes you a better writer. So I would say the extent I was able to read good literature, that helped a great deal. Law is about persuading people. Now I don't want, I don't want to encourage my children or you encourage, say, you should argue more. But thoughtfully debating questions is good preparation for it. I mean, I don't know that I have particular insight on what's good, but I would say in terms of law and what I do today, liking reading and liking writing and doing as much of it as you can is good preparation.
Jennifer Church, I think, had a question.
Thank you for speaking to us today, Mr. Chief Justice.
Sure.
Now, I know that as Chief Justice, you like to get as much consensus as you can, preferably a unanimous or near unanimous decision. But is there a trade-off if you try too hard for an agreement that maybe the court issues a really narrow ruling that doesn't provide clear guidance for future cases? And how do you navigate that trade-off?
Well, there sure is a trade-off. It's a very conscious and deliberate one. It's kind of like what I was talking about with Brown versus Board of Education. It was a revolutionary decision, a dramatic one, but in its own way, didn't answer a lot of questions. There were a lot more questions left unsettled, even though a basic and central one was. And you do give that up. And frankly, when we're discussing cases, that's an issue. No, you should go on and decide this. People aren't going to know what to do. Yes, you've decided this case, but what about all these other ones? And, I think when you get the reason I get to decide cases and why I have life tenure and why I get to interpret the Constitution, as I was mentioning in connection with Marbury versus Madison, because I have to decide a case. I'm a judge. You sue somebody else. You have to decide it. And if the Constitution's involved, you have to say what the Constitution means. As soon as you go beyond deciding the case, it begins to undermine the legitimacy of what you're doing. If I don't have to decide this issue because it's not presented in the case, well, then what authority do I have to interpret the Constitution to do that? So I tend to try, when I can, to narrow the decision to the particular case in front of me. Now, sometimes you don't just say you win and you lose, you have to articulate the principle. And when you articulate the principle, that often will decide other cases other than the dispute between you and the other person. And that's fine. But I do think you have to be very careful not to go very far beyond the case before you. Do you give up resolving more cases? Yes. But I'm not a congressman. I'm not writing a law. I don't want to say I want to resolve all these cases. My legitimacy depends upon the necessity to decide a particular case, and so I worry about it when I get further beyond that. I'm also more likely to be wrong. If you get beyond the particular issue that people are focusing on, maybe there are issues that are implicated in this other area that you don't really know about. And I think you're more likely to be right the narrower your focus.
Is Alexis Clark here?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Roberts. My question to you is, how do you in your role as Chief Justice of the United States ensure that voices of minorities, underrepresented minorities, including women, Latinx, LGBTQ communities, and African Americans are heard?
Well, if it's a question of being heard in the sense of understanding the legal arguments that they present that might be different from other legal arguments, we depend heavily on the lawyers to present all the arguments for us. And they do a very good job in the area you're talking about, whether it's particular cases that implicate the concerns of minorities in a way that's different than they implicate other concerns. Those interests are very well represented in the Supreme Court. We have a very good bar. And of course, we certainly focus on those briefs as well as on the others. I don't know if there's other ways in which we particularly make sure. I mean, it's during the arguments and questions. We have cases, obviously, that involve minority rights in particular, and we address those broadly, and the arguments are presented. I did a case that was the first opinion I had this year, the Buck case, about an individual who was sentenced to death, an African-American individual, in a situation in which an expert opinion was presented that was fairly read as suggesting to the jury that an individual was more likely to be violence prone because of his race. And that was a situation in which the advocacy, I think, was very good in presenting to the court the significance of that historic embodiment of prejudice in the myth of the violent African-American male and the historic role that that bias and bigotry had played and why it was important, even though the testimony itself was very small in terms of the time of the trial and all. As I wrote in the opinion, even though it was tiny portion of the trial transcript, you know, some poisons are toxic in small doses. And the arguments in those cases presented that perspective to us. Now, it's a perspective that might not have been presented in other presentations if we didn't have full and adequate representation of the particular perspective you're talking about. So, you know, ensuring it in every case, I don't know. I don't know. You certainly would worry that it wasn't, those perspectives were not represented. But we have a very good bar that does a good job, and that case in particular was one that struck me in terms of the presentation of arguments that might not otherwise have been apparent.
Mary Votto.
Chief Justice, thank you for being here today.
Sure.
You commented that justices are nonpartisan, even if the process through appointing them is. But naturally, people have vastly different upbringings and backgrounds that can shape how they interpret the Constitution. Do you think that the difference in interpretations of the Constitution, because of different upbringings and backgrounds, which can have political impacts, is a hindrance or a help to the court?
Well, you know, the objective is that a particular background not affect how you read the law. I do think people bring different experiences to their job, and that can make sure that the reading of the law by everybody on the court is fully informed. It certainly is a better court now than it was in the era of FDR's time when you'd had the nine old men, and that was it. Fortunately, we don't have that situation anymore. But I do resist the idea of some sort of proportional representation on the court, that it should have the same percentage of, you know, particular groups, society at large, because it is not a representative body. It is not our job to represent the people of the United States. That's the job of the people across the street in Congress. Our job is to interpret the law to the best of our ability. And yes, it is good and important to have a broad range of different experiences and interests represented on the court. But it should never get to the position where you have identity politics coming into the appointment of justices on the bench.
Now, because our faculty and deans are students, too, there is a dean, I think, who wanted to ask a question, Dean Shaker Garde, who is our Dean of Engineering.
I hope it's not an engineering question. That would
Given that you stated the origin of Newton's third law. So we engineers and scientists pursue truth about how nature works. And when we understand it, it's codified in laws such as the Newton's laws of motion.
Now, our democracy at times seems to be overwhelmed by fake news or political manipulation of truth. And so as a member and as a leader of one of the most important and impartial branches of our government, what do you view as your responsibility, and perhaps more broadly, the responsibility of the federal judiciary toward truth? How do you carry out that responsibility, and what are some of the challenges that you face in that direction?
I'm tempted to say, and maybe it's where I'll end up, that my business is not truth, it's law. You hope, to a large extent, truth informs the job of the legislators in enacting the law. But the question before me, and it's a provocative question, but in my work, I'm never asked to decide what truth is. I'm asked to decide what the law is and apply the law to the particular facts before me. Now, obviously, truth comes into play when the question is, you know, did he or did he not do it? That's an objective reality of truth. But it's usually a question that, for example, in that situation is going to have been decided by a jury. And then that jury's decision may be reviewed. By the time a question gets to me, it's usually not a question about what happened. It's a question about, was the procedure in place adequate and constitutional when the jury decided what happened? So I think in many ways I have to say I am just thinking out loud, which of course is very dangerous, but it's... In many ways, I don't want to say the truth would be a distraction, but I do have to keep in mind my role, which is not to substitute, for example, myself for the jury. You think, well, if I was on that jury, I would have decided this, because it's the jury's role. And I have to simply decide, well, was the jury properly instructed as what the law was before they made their decision, something like that. Truth may be much more in your realm than mine, because you're looking at sort of ultimate causes in terms of physical phenomena, if I'm getting that right. I'm not. I'm looking at more immediate causes in terms of what the law governs, because the law doesn't go back to the basic elements of physics.
Maybe I can add a dimension to it. So when we think about Newton's laws, they work in the United States as well as they work in India or China or on Mars or Moon. And similarly, and so there's a universality to it.
Are you sure about that? I mean, that's sort of a...
but there's a universality to it, and you spoke about uniformity, if not universality. And so when we think about humans and how we treat each other, when you think of human rights, there's a universality to... There must be universality, there must be truth. And so in sort of the modern context, you know, how do you uphold through your role and through federal judiciary that truth?
Well, again, I may be just saying the same thing I said before. My job is not to enforce universal truth. It's to enforce and interpret the Constitution, which is it's a revered document, but it is a document. It's a contract between the people, the government and the governed, whether it adequately embodies universal truth or not, I don't know. I know, for example, that it protects freedom of speech from regulation.